Let's return now to Psalm number 7. Okay, if you were not with us last hour, I can briefly, I think, bring you up to speed and say that in the superscription, which is called a Shigayon of David, which he sang to the Lord concerning, and in the Hebrew has the words of Cush, the Benjamite. And we find out that the Benjamites and Cush among them slandered David all of the time. And we ought to be sure we have fixed in our mind, because it's really the subject of everything that we're doing, is two words, slander and libel. Basically, both mean the same thing. Two parts to it, slander or libel. The only difference is slander is spoken, libel is written. And this distinction has legal standing. But you have to have two things, false statements. But false statements alone are not sufficiently to make slander. If someone would say of you who have blonde hair that she's a redhead, that is a false statement. But it doesn't injure your reputation. You're not going to have a reputation just because you're a redhead. Jenny? Okay. You're not going to necessarily have a reputation just because you have red hair. And therefore, while the statement spoken about you was false, it didn't damage your character. It didn't malign your character. It didn't injure your reputation in any way. And slander is that which is spoken. Libel is that which is written, but contains false statements that injure your reputation. And this fact is what David lived with for 30 years. For some reason, he had to bear the burden of people who lied about him all of the time. And we put as your caption verse to go with Psalm number 7, and you may want to pen or pencil it in right next to the psalm, and that is 1 Samuel 24 and verse 9, where David says this, "Why do you listen," speaking to Saul, "why do you listen to the words of men saying, David seeks to harm you?" And that was a particular slander that David had to live with over and over and over and over in this particular section. So we outline the psalm then that begins with an appeal for delivery. He asserts his innocence. He argues that God needs to take action. And he applies a doctrine and he ascribes praise to the Lord. So under those headings then, we begin with, number one, his appeal. Chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. First thing to do in any psalm is catch the mood. And the mood is confusion. And I say confusion because here's what David is saying. He says, "Lord, I cannot figure it out. I am absolutely innocent. Why do you allow these people to go on sinning against me? Why don't you do something?" And David will come right down to a bottom line and he will say, "God, would you please wake up?" And it's the idea that God is sitting in a chair passively. And this confuses him. So it is the confusion of why does God not act? Why does God not act? I can't understand that. Anybody that's lived much more than 10 minutes understands something about that, because you look at a circumstance in your own life and say, why does this have to... It's not fair. And I think if you can make one statement out about life, that would be it, wouldn't it? Life is not fair. And over you can give example after example of you did the right thing and you came out on the short end of the stick. or you didn't say that and they said you did. They lied about you. They did this or they did that. And much of life is that. And David is in a mood where he just can't contain it anymore. I've sat and I've waited and nothing happens. I'm confused. Can you tell me, God, why it is that I'm innocent and you let these characters go on lying about me? Can you give me reason for that? As a matter of fact, he not only says, can you give me reason, but David is courageous enough to say, Lord, it's time for it to stop. Get on your feet, Lord. Stop sleeping, Lord. Now, all of that is in the midst of great respect, but also a great deal of honesty about his condition. So, you begin with this mood. Alexander McLaren, who was a great expositor, one of the best, always eloquent, said, Psalm 6 wails like a soft mute. Psalm 7 peals like a trumpet of judgment. And that's exactly what you've got in this context. Now notice as you open up in verses 1 and 2, you have first a prayer, then a metaphor. First a prayer, then a metaphor. And the prayer is 7:1. The first thing to note grammatically about the way it's put together is that in the normal Hebrew order, and we've been over this many times, but you need to know it, the normal order in Hebrew is VSO, verb, subject, object, only written the opposite way. So that normal order would be Genesis 1:1, created, that's the verb, God, that's a subject, heavens and earth, that's the object. And that's the way Genesis 1:1 is written. It's this normal order, no emphasis, nothing is underlined, it's just the fact. Now, if you want to underline something, then change the order. So that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and you wanted to say, I'd like for the word God to jump off the page, you would just take it and you would make it subject, verb, object, and that automatically underscores the subject, and therefore you'd be saying, and God created the heavens and the earth. If you wanted to emphasize heavens and the earth, that it wasn't something else, then you would put the object first, and it would be the heavens and the earth God created. And in this context of the Psalm number 7, the words that are first in English are the subject, and they're also first in the Hebrew. So, they're underscored. And therefore, David begins by saying, O Lord. Now, why does he make that emphatic? Because he wants to say to us, there is my focus. Do you want to know what I'm looking at? I'm looking at the Lord. Do you want to know where my eyes are? They're on the Lord. And therefore, focus on God is a key. Focus on God is the key to all of David's victories. When he came against Goliath, had he focused on Goliath, he would have run. But his eyes weren't on Goliath. He stood there in front of Goliath, insurmountable odds, and says, the battle is God's. And he wasn't looking at Goliath, he's looking at him. And as simple a point as that may make, the thrust and a key to David is where his eyes rest. When his eyes get off the Lord, he is one of the most ingenious schemers you've ever found. When he's not looking at God, he can come up with more stuff. Remember with Psalm 34? His eyes were not on the Lord as he comes in before the king of Gath, the Philistine, and they all say down there, we know who you are, you're David. Scares him, scares him spitless. Not really, because with his eyes off the Lord, it says he feigned madness and spit in his beard and scribbled on the walls and so forth. And consequently, that's David with his eyes off. And it's almost funny, almost humor of what David will come up with when he's not looking at the Lord. He was a genius as far as schemes is concerned. However, when his eyes are on the Lord, and as this psalm begins, this is where he's looking. O Lord my God. Do you see a New Testament doctrine there? You can put a personal pronoun, a possessive pronoun, on the name God. Paul says, I thank my God for you all. That's one of those things that when you point it out, it is so simple. When you begin to think about it, it's awesome. The God of the universe will allow you to put a possessive pronoun on his name. My God. And it's something simply, as you're riding along in the car, to think about. God will let me possess him so I can call him my God. And that is the way David starts out. Now notice that's followed by a metaphor. And the metaphor is found in verse 2. One of David's favorite figures for his enemies is a wild animal, in particular being clawed to death by a lion. He says, lest he tear my soul like a lion, dragging me away, and there is none to deliver. This is one of his favorite figures, is the lion. Now, in the lion figure, in order to see the force of it, and how much suffering it indicated, go to Psalm 22. Psalm number 22. And we find out that the lion metaphor, being torn by a lion, was sufficient to indicate suffering to the extent that Jesus used that metaphor when he was suffering on the cross. And so chapter 22, verse 13, he speaks of those that are persecuting him about the cross. They open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and roaring lion. So he says the lion metaphor is strong enough to define the suffering of the cross. Verse 21, save me, Jesus says, from the lion's mouth. And so the metaphor is adequate to express the most extreme agony and the most extreme suffering. And so as he opens the psalm, he says, I'm about to be torn to pieces by the lions, that is my enemies, and I appeal to you, save me, deliver me. Now, here's why. And let's put the verb that he uses there, save. And it's a petition, so we'll put an exclamation point with it. It's an imperative. I want you to do this. And the implication now is he knows God is going to say, why should I? Why should I do that? And verse 3 asserts why. His assertion is innocent, 7, 3 through 5. Why should I rescue you, David? And notice, as we had from our last hour, the if-then pattern. You've got three ifs forwarded by an or. So that verse 2, verse 3, O Lord my God, if I have done this, if there is injustice in my hands, if I have rewarded evil to my friend, or if I have plundered him, four ifs, who without cause was my adversary, then, verse 5, here's what should happen. Now, the assertion goes back and describes the kind of suffering that he's having in verse 1. Verse 1 and 2 speaks of undeserved suffering. Speaks of undeserved suffering. And that's important to make that distinction. Because suffering that we really deserve, though the consequences are not pleasant, you at least recognize that, well, I brought this on myself. someone gets offended at what you said, and the friendship is damaged, but you got to back off and say, you opened your yap. You know, you said what they're angry at, and if you just kept your mouth shut, this wouldn't have happened. So, and we do this all the time, do we not? As a matter of fact, what would you guess? What part of our suffering is brought on ourselves? What part of our suffering is really deserved? What part of is it, well, you had it coming? But he's not talking about this. In fact, he's trying to say, that is not what I'm talking about. I didn't have it coming. And so the theme here is, the theme introduced is undeserved suffering. And verse 3 makes it very, very clear that this is what he has in mind. Now, there's one thing about verse 3 that's a little naive. What is it? If you're innocent, you won't suffer. Is that real life or not? Or is it a reality in this life that the innocent do truly suffer? And so I think we could say David is a little naive, but we've all been through it. We all believe most of the time that we deserve better treatment than we get. And that's just part of the human breast. And yet, in this context, as a matter of fact, we could go a little bit further. Innocence and godliness is not an exemption from suffering. It is probably, in this world, a ticket to suffering. And that follows from the teaching of Jesus. If this world is governed by Satan, if, as 1 John says, it's in the arms of the wicked one, and if Jesus says, if the world hated me, it'll hate you, then we should not be surprised at suffering. But nonetheless, in the Old Testament, the big thing and the important thing to an Old Testament saint was, well, let me, before I say it, what is the major theme in the age in which we live? Is it not God's grace? Even Paul says, you're not under the law, you're under grace. And God's grace looms very, very large. In the Old Testament, while there was plenty of grace, what was the major theme, the major concern? The major concern was justice. That's hard for us to identify with. For a psalmist to say, if you dishonor God, may your babies starve to death. And we say, oh, that's not nice to say. Well, they were concerned. You offended God. And if God has been offended, we are concerned with justice. And this would be appropriate. And that's the way you have to read many of these. They were concerned about God's reputation. And they would look at it this way. If you offend God, anything that comes your way is deserved. Because that was a horrible thing, and justice was in the forefront. Now, with this psalm, this is the same thing that David is thinking. I am innocent. God should judge those that lie against me, that slander me. And justice is at the forefront of his thought in this particular particular context. So, notice David in his statement of his assertion of his innocence is going to look at two kinds of people. One, and I'll put it in first person, I have treated my friends justly. I have treated friends justly. I haven't wronged a friend. And that's going to be his first thought. His second, well, let's read that. O Lord, my God, if I have done this, and I would put with that word this, all of the slander, all of the lies told about him, all wrapped up in that word this. If I have done this, the things they've lied about, if I tried to kill Saul, if I've wronged a friend, if I have misunderstood someone who was really a friend and I called him a foe, if I've done any of this, if there is injustice in my hands, if I have rewarded evil to, now let me give you a Hebrew word, or the Hebrew word here, and just forget my friend for a moment. Shalom. What's shalom mean? It's peace. And it's shalomi with a suffix meaning my, and our translation is put friend. If you go off into your margin, it says him who was at peace with me. Much, much better. If I have rewarded evil to him who was really at peace with me. In other words, I've treated my friends fairly. If I have misjudged someone and said he's an enemy, and when they are really a friend, I don't think I've done that. Next, he's treated his foes justly. I've treated my friends justly, and now I have treated my foes. And that's the theme. I've treated friend and foe in a very honest manner. Now, unfortunately, our translation, when you read verse 4, if I have rewarded evil to him who dwells at peace with me, or have plundered him who without cause was my adversary, if I were an English teacher, I would say revise that sentence. And if I were a translator, I would say translate it the Hebrew, the way the Hebrew order is, which is this. If I have plundered him who was my adversary without cause. I think the way it reads, that without cause kind of hangs there. And you don't know where does this, how does this put together? If I have plundered him who without cause was my enemy or my adversary. It means adversary and there was no reason to be. Adversary without cause. So the emphasis then is on his total innocence. Now, everybody, when under pressure, protests innocence. I didn't do it. It wasn't my fault. Every politician, that's his first words, isn't it? Completely innocent of all charges. And you could say now, David, how do we know you're not just putting on? How do you know that you're really honest? Well, two reasons. Number one, he's talking to God. And it doesn't do us well to lie to God. And David knew that. Second, if I'm lying, give me a 30-day sentence. If I'm lying, kill me. Take my life. And so notice in verse 5, we know that he protests innocence, but is the protest true? And verse 5, directed to God, and if one had just lied, these words are very strong. So the essence of the prayer is, if I've been unjust, may enemies continue to pursue, may they overtake me, and may they win. Verse 5. Let my enemy pursue my soul, let my enemy overtake it, and let him trample my life down to the ground and lay my glory in the dust. And that is addressed to God. So he's saying, if I am lying about my innocence, crush me. If I am not telling the truth about my innocence in verse 4, kill me. And he's not addressing that to Saul. He's addressing that to God. And therefore he says, let the enemy, again, continue to pursue me, successfully pursue me, and wipe me out. All right, with that then, with protesting his innocence, having done nothing to wrong against either friend or foe, we now go to David's argument for action. David's argument for action, and that's in 7, 6 through 11. Now, he begins by addressing God with three imperatives. I heard a radio program here last week that I just cringed at. And this idiot preacher, most of us are, made in the service, he kept saying, "Sick 'em, Jesus, sick 'em." And it made me sick. Jesus is not a puppy dog, you know, and that was the whole thrust of the whole thing. I stand here in my pulpit and I sick Jesus on people and on things, and it's to me blasphemy. But now how does this differ from what we have in Psalm 6 with the three imperatives, which are: 1, arise. Lift up. Wake up. One of the excellent interlinear Hebrew Bibles is by Kohlenberg. And Kohlenberg always indicates an imperative or a command next to the English word with an exclamation point. And all of these have exclamation points, which means they are order. Or orders. And he's addressing God. And notice this, verse 6. Arise, Lord, in your anger. Lift up thyself against the rage of my adversaries, and arouse yourself for me. Now, I've taken the third one, the arise, lift up, and arouse. Arise and arouse are two different Hebrew words. The word for rise is simply a word for stand up, as over against sitting down. Our English colloquialism would be, get off your duff. Stand up. Don't just sit there. Second, the word lift up, again, is lift up. For action. Rise up for action. And wake up, or arouse in our English text, is a word that means wake up. Now, what does David see God as doing? He sees God as sitting and dozing. Sitting and sleeping. Do you sense in this any irreverence? Look at verse 17. I will give thanks to the Lord according to His righteousness. I will sing praise to the name of the Most High. Most High, El Elyon, word for the key word in the Old Testament for the sovereign ruler of the universe. So back at verse 6 then, we don't have any irreverence. It just is the way he perceives God. And believe me, if you can't identify with that, if the God, and if you've never asked the question, why doesn't God do something? You haven't lived. I've given this illustration before. John Wolver, former president of Dallas Theological Seminary, had a son who went through medical school. Then he went through seminary to go to a foreign country to be a medical missionary. The night of graduation, left the seminary and head-on collision. Killed instantly. Now, I don't understand that. And I know that many people come along and say, well, the Lord knows best. Is that really what your gut tells you? Don't you often get the gut feeling that, and I have no problem praying this way, because in a sense I meet it and in a sense I don't. Lord, things shouldn't go this way. It's not in your best interest. Now you can come on from one angle. Who in the world do you think you are? to decide what is in God's interest. Well, I have perceptions, don't you? And I don't care how pious you may be, you have questioned the activity of God. Not only relative to His universe, if God is so sovereign, why doesn't He do something about sin? If God is so in control, why is most of the world starving to death? Why doesn't He do something? Why doesn't He act? And anyone who hasn't had that question, and I don't mean it an irreverent question. You mean it as a question that is reverent and respectful, and yet, God, I can't have... It's sort of like, say, pardon me, God. Be gracious to me. But here's what's in my heart. And the important thing is over and over and over and over in the book of Psalms, David unloads his perceptions and God says, oh, David, that's so good. I'm going to inspire those words and give them to God's people for all time. And why do we have this psalm recorded? Because for us sitting here, and if you don't have to admit it, if you don't want to, but just all I can say is, why don't you get real someday and stop the performance and say, you have thought many times God was sitting and sleeping and doing nothing. And that's important to recognize because you can never deal with the problem that you hide. You can never deal with the problem when we pretend there isn't one. And in this context, you have this on the part of David. And I think it's interesting that while he sees God as passive, he's not afraid to express his thoughts in prayer. He's not hesitant to ask God to change things. And by the way, I think this might be a good time to really define what is prayer. And I distinguish prayer in the sense of what is prayer petition? What is a prayer petition? What do you mean? Very simple definition. A prayer petition is asking God to take action and change things. Asking God to take action and change things. And as you look at petitions, isn't that basically what they are? David says, oh Lord, don't be angry with me forever. What's he saying? Would you change your attitude toward me? Instead of being angry with me, would you be felicitous toward me? It's a request to take action and change things. And he's got this idea here. Now, notice in these words, God is not saying, David, suppress it. Don't even think that I'm passive. Don't even think that I'm sleeping. Is that what God says? God is more personal than that. What God says to David? Tell me about it. You think I'm taking a course? This is amazing. You think I'm taking a course of action that ought to change? Say so. And David does so in the fullest sense of the word, not only here, but elsewhere. Now, this is all appearance. This is all appearance. And it's appearance in contrast to reality. It looks like God is asleep. It looks like God is sitting. That's appearance. Is it reality? Keep your finger here and look at Psalm 121, 3 and 4. And 121, 3 and 4 gives us reality. Notice this beautiful psalm. verse 3, He, speaking of the Lord, will not allow your foot to slip. He who keeps you will not slumber. How do you put that with Psalm 7? He does not slumber. David turns around and says, wake up. How do you put these two truths together? Well, you put them together in terms of wake up was David's perception. And we are free to let our perceptions be known to God. Not only are we free, but it's healthy. To suppress is not healthy. To express is healthy. Verse 4, behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. And that is as true as Psalm 7. So David says, look, I know you don't slumber, I know you don't sleep, but to this poor man's human mind, I hear your snores, and I got a problem. Would you please stop snoring and do something for me? Are we identifying? Do you understand what we're talking about? You sense this many times? And I think very often what we fail to do is we say, suppress your perceptions. Don't dare say them. You tell God to wake up and He'll slap you down. No, He doesn't. He will, from the standpoint of your perception, wake up and act. And basically that's what prayer is, asking God to take action to change things. And David does it and does it repeatedly. Okay, I think that's a good place to stop. We'll pick up next time with his argument, and his argument is going to go in two parts. And before we pack, see if, you know, all Bible study is reading with your eyes open. And if you look at verses 6 through 11, and reading it through, I ask myself, what do you see? Well, I see something. Verses 6, 7, and 8 are different than 9, 10, and 11. What is different about 9, 10, and 11 as compared to 6, 7, and 8? 6, 7, and 8 is asking for delivery for me. 9 through 11 is asking for delivery for everybody else. And let's, in closing, just read it through quickly. Arise, O Lord, in thine anger. Lift up thyself against the rage of my adversaries. Arouse yourself, or thyself, for me. Thou hast appointed judgment. Let the assembly of the peoples encompass thee, and over them return thou on high. The Lord judges the peoples. Vindicate me, O Lord, according to my righteousness and my integrity that is in me. And then suddenly, except for one time, the word me disappears. And the whole thing blossoms out into the following. O, let the evil of the wicked come to an end, but establish, not me, the righteous. And verse 5. You do have in verse 10 a reference to my. But again, my shield is with God, who saves thee, not me, but the upright in heart. So 6 through 8 is about delivering me. 9 through 11 is about delivering everyone. In closing, he's asking for judgment. And in closing, we ought to remember this. The prophets always paint the judgment of God on one canvas. They always picture Sodom and Gomorrah as having a finale. And the finale is the ultimate judgment. And it's all on the same canvas. The judgment of the flood looks forward down to the final judgment. Sodom and Gomorrah looks forward to the final judgment. And we'll establish this in our next study tonight in Psalm 7, that it's all one picture. And in these verses, he's going to take us all the way to the time that God makes everything right, and the wicked perish, and the righteous prosper eventually. But it doesn't look like it now, does it? You know what that says to us? If we're going to walk at all, we walk by faith, not by perception. By faith, not by sight. And therefore that which sight denies, faith affirms, because it builds on the Scriptures. Father, we're thankful today for Your Word. We're thankful that the poor, sinful, failing human thoughts that we have, we are not forbidden to bring them to Your presence. We're not forbidden to say, wake up. In all reverence for the Sovereign God, we're thankful that all of our human feelings, even the sinful ones, can be made open and honest before You. May we recognize it's not until we recognize how wrong our perceptions are that we can ever grasp the reality of Your Word. That we must express, as David did in Psalm 7, that God is asleep before he really learns that the God of Israel never slumbers. Psalm 7 before Psalm 121. In Christ's name, amen.